After 21 years of dictatorship and a long period of political reopening, with the negotiation of a sweeping amnesty along the way, Brazil finally approved a democratic constitution in 1988 and returned to holding direct elections for president the following year. Step by step, the country was rebuilding its democracy, creating new institutions guaranteeing citizens more mechanisms of representation, participation, and control, expanding social rights, and facing up to some aspects of socioeconomic inequality. Brazil's political culture, however, changed little, and democratic education remained precarious. Instead of putting the previous decades into debate, Brazilian elites thought that a silent national conciliation would be more practical, and certainly more comfortable for them, as they themselves had participated in the dictatorship. Fast forward to the 2010s. As social media flooded Brazil's public debate with political questions, many lacked the political training to interpret the country's complexities and reject simplistic solutions. Corruption scandals and unfulfilled promises also contributed to inflate populist radicalism. In a wave of anti-establishment sentiment, militarism resurfaced in Brazil and made a return to the presidency under a political figure who presented himself as an outsider. He was retired army captain Jair Bolsonaro, an open nostalgist for the military dictatorship, torture, and the treatment of opponents in the old modes of leftist enemies of the country. In his 4 years in office, Bolsonaro followed the script of autocratization and tried to undermine the functioning illegitimacy of several democratic institutions, including the electoral system. He went further, though. The federal police believes he pressured the military commanders around him to carry out a coup after losing the 2022 elections, just as they had done in 1964, in a coup that Bolsonaro made a point of officially celebrating more than half a century on, in the middle of the 21st century. The ex-president is under investigation. The silence of Brazil's post-dictatorship national conciliation had been explicitly broken. My name is Isabella Cruz, and this is the last episode of our special podcast mini-series Love It or Leave It, the Brazilian military dictatorship from within to abroad.
Warm and friendly relations with the people of Brazil. To our sede do governo.
Contem com as forças armadas pela democracia e pela liberdade.
In the second half of the 1970s, the pressure for political reopening only increased. Social movements such as the Women's Movement for Amnesty called for the release of all political prisoners and the possibility of a safe return home for those who had to protect themselves abroad. Cornered by the exhaustion of economic growth and criticism on the international stage, the Brazilian government realized that it would be difficult to take its authoritarian regime much further. The government, therefore, decided to champion the cause of a broad amnesty process, so broad that it should also encompass human rights violations committed by the military and police against civilians. This was, of course, a distortion of the amnesty idea that the opposition had sought, as the situations on each side were very different. The opposition had already been punished throughout the dictatorship, without due legal process. Nor did they have access to institutional means of contesting the government. That was not the case for state agents.
When people were fighting for amnesty in the 70s, there was this discourse that amnesty should be wide, should be general. But what was the sense at that time? The sense was that the very dictatorship was concerned that it should restrict amnesty only to those, let's say, that would be the lighter crimes. So crimes that the dictatorship called blood crimes could not be included in the amnesty. And political opponents were just saying, no, the amnesty must be general, must be wide.
The voice you've just heard is Emílio Meyer, who will be with us in this episode. He's a constitutional law professor at the Federal University of Minas Gerais, where he coordinates the Center for Studies on Transitional Justice.
in that procedure, what they did was to insert in the bill a provision that it is the expression connected crimes. So the amnesty would be granted to political crimes and to crimes connected to the political crimes. So it is a kind of something that is not properly clear. It's not something that is recognizing that they committed crimes. They could not do it. They would not do it to recognize that they were committing crimes throughout the dictatorship. So they inserted something that was not particularly clear, but that could be used by the conservative institutions of judiciary in Brazil, for the prosecutors in Brazil, to keep on with that idea that we are moving with a kind of conciliation.
Under the government of General João Figueiredo, the opposition had to accept these terms as it was the only possible way forward. The exact definition of connected crimes would be left for later. In the following years, decisions from the military courts helped to consolidate the idea that the amnesty law really shielded state agents from criminal prosecution. Unlike what happened at the end of the dictatorships in Argentina and Chile, for example, those in Brazil who insisted on punishing the military did not have political strength in the institutional field.
If we take a look on what was going on in Chile and Argentina, we can say that there was part of an effort for doing the transition, for leading the transition in a political sense, using this, flagship, in the sense that we need to take care of these crimes that were so horrible and they were so heinous and they were so they could be labeled as crimes against humanity or gross violations of human rights right after the transition. So in the 80s in Chile, actually in the 90s in Chile and in the 80s in Argentina, there was a wider sense that everyone knows that those heinous crimes were committed by the military. There were numbers that were really impactful, and all of those things, they were part of a political discourse to do the transition there. If we pay attention to what the political parties discussed here in Brazil in our transition, themes such as that, what to do with amnesty, how to deal with holding the armed forces accountable and its members. These were things that, in a certain sense, were thought of between 1986, 1987, 1988, as something that could create new kinds of reaction or important steps by the very military, in the sense that they could, for instance, provoke a new coup d'etat and so on. So a kind of a discourse of fear that something would again happen and be part of the political enterprises of the armed forces, which was not actually the case. We can see that the what we would need for a dictatorship to stand would only disappear throughout the 70s in Brazil and the 80s.
In this manner, Brazil made its transition to democracy without criminally punishing its dictators or their subordinates, also with far fewer memory initiatives than its neighbors. To this day, there is little institutional support for projects that seek to remember the atrocities of the dictatorship period. Progress was made when it came to reparations for victims and their families, although commissions dedicated to this end were only set up after 1995, during the Fernando Henrique Cardoso government. But there was no broad debate about the delays that an authoritarian state causes in the most varied of fields, from science to the arts, including controlling corruption. Brazil did not discuss what constitutes an effective fight against crime, the benefits of political pluralism, or the necessity of the armed forces' political neutrality. The penal populism, the manipulation of the idea of patriotism, and the military threats remain. When formulating the 1988 Constitution, the military also guaranteed that it would have room to act internally in exceptional public security operations. They also guaranteed that they would continue to have an exclusive military justice system which could even try civilians in certain situations. Despite this, you could say that Brazil had a stable relationship with its armed forces in the 1990s and 2000s. During that period, the Brazilian military gained prominence and funds when commanding a United Nations operation in Haiti. They also contested the demarcation of indigenous lands in the Amazon. But in general, politics seemed much more distant from the barracks than in previous decades. An expert on the topic, Anaís Passos, joins us to explain what this process was like. She's a professor at the Department of Sociology and Political Science at the Federal University of Santa Catarina and a member of the research network The Military in Politics in Brazil at the King's Brazil Institute.
It is true that there was a withdrawal of the military from politics, especially in the mid-1990s. The first governments before that was very under a military tutelage. I mean, it's true that there was a withdrawal of the military from politics. We see that with the not very significant number of militaries that were elected as deputies and senators now in the first years of democracy.
It was in this context that the Supreme Court in 2010 judged an action by the Brazilian Bar Association to finally challenge the application of the amnesty law to common crimes committed by agents of repression against political opponents, such as homicides, torture, forced disappearances, and even sexual abuse against the women detained. The Bar Association argued that the principles of the 1988 Democratic Constitution did not authorize an interpretation of the aforementioned connected crimes in that sense. It is necessary to remember that in relation to the opposition, the 1979 law itself made it clear that terrorism, robbery, kidnapping, and personal attacks would not be covered by the amnesty. Professor Emilio Meyer explains a central argument of the case.
When we pay attention to the text of the 1988 Constitution, what we see is that amnesty was only directed to people who were by any means affected by institutional acts or complementary acts that were produced by the dictatorship. So there is no sense in thinking that the usage of these institutional acts or complementary acts would be to direct or would address people that were supporting the regime, or what we could describe as the perpetrators of the torture and all the crimes that took place during those times.
But the Supreme Court, by 7-2, decided to avoid problems with the military and favored the idea of conciliation. The then president of the court, Justice César Peluso, said, "If it's true that each people solves their historical problems according to their culture, their feelings, their nature, and also their history, Brazil chose the path of compromise."
Well, I think that there is a strange relationship between Brazilian judicial branch and the armed forces in Brazil. Both of them, if you stop to think, they are institutions that are dominated by privileges, by prerogatives, and by very, in a kind of sense, a type of creonism that would sustain the idea that, yes, they can take part in certain sense in some kind of politics, but especially to secure their own privilege, to secure their own prerogatives.
After the Supreme Court's conservative decision, an appeal was filed and never taken to trial, which keeps the case open to this day. During this period, the legal discussion on the topic of amnesty advanced significantly in the international field. In 2010, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights ruled that Brazil must investigate crimes committed by the state during the dictatorship. In 2018, another court decision on the case of Vladimir Herzog, a journalist murdered in military custody, stressed that the crimes against humanity committed by the regime have no statute of limitations and must therefore be submitted to justice. The Supreme Court, however, did not return to the matter. As a result, a series of other cases in lower courts have been at a standstill for a long time.
In any case, many criminal lawsuits were filed after 2010. So what the federal prosecutors did was to say, okay, we need to obey the Inter-American decision of Inter-American Court of Human Rights ruling. We know that the Federal Supreme Court decided something in a different way, but we are just using the application of the convention, of the American Convention of Human Rights here in Brazil, and in this sense, we need to obey to the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. So we have something like 50-55 criminal lawsuits that were filed in Brazil, even with the final decision in the ADPF 153, and only two of these criminal lawsuits resulted in condemnations. And if you stop to think, they were condemnations that involved only civil authorities, not military authorities from the dictatorship. So there is a very small step that was taken in these criminal lawsuits, and think about it, only two of them, and we have 55 more to be ruled upon, but we need to move on with these criminal lawsuits even without the final decision from the Federal Supreme Court.
While the judiciary was deciding how to deal with the past and with the international human rights system, that issue heated up in political circles. A National Truth Commission established by the then President Dilma Rousseff in 2012 sought to uncover the crimes committed by the Brazilian state during the military dictatorship. Even if punishment was impossible, the idea was to shine a light on the wrongdoings carried out in this period.
A sombra e a mentira não são capazes de promover a concórdia. O Brasil merece a verdade. As novas gerações merecem a verdade. E, sobretudo, merecem a verdade factual aqueles que perderam amigos e parentes e que continuam sofrendo como se eles morressem de novo e sempre, a cada dia.
The advent of the Truth Commission was enough for generals, some even relatives of those being investigated, to abandon any type of political neutrality. The armed forces clashed head-on with the president, who, according to the Constitution, is their commander-in-chief.
There was a reaction from militaries, from active duty, and from retired against that list, and they were being persecuted. And from that, I would identify the beginning of a more open, more explicit politicization of the military. Because as I said before, there was a withdrawal of the military from politics. That doesn't mean that they changed their mentality or that even the politicians, they were not seeing the militaries as allies, but there was a decrease of their significance in politics. And in the 2010, we see again an increase of militaries elected as deputies and senators, and this is going to be more explicit, more significant in the 2018 election.
The political situation only got worse. After years of political and economic stability, which placed Brazil at the center of international attention, a cauldron of popular dissatisfaction began to bubble. catalyzed by price increases in public transportation, street protests took over the country in 2013, opening space for new groups to gain a foothold in the political arena. Moreover, the major anti-corruption investigation, Operation Car Wash, which began the following year, put the traditional political system in the spotlight. The country plunged into an economic crisis during this period, and the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff in 2016 brought to power a vice president without popular support. Throughout this entire process, generals felt increasingly free to speak out on political issues. So during the Michel Temer government from 2016 to 2018, members of the military were given important positions in the government, and even as advisors to a Supreme Court justice. Surfing the wave of the crisis, Jair Bolsonaro, who had been an irrelevant backbencher in Congress for decades, began building his presidential candidacy on social media and television programs, as well as his machine of fake news and attacks on his opponents. When voting for the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, for example, Bolsonaro paid homage to a notorious torturer from the dictatorship. In the late 60s and at the beginning of the following decade, Dilma herself had been a member of a Marxist guerrilla group that fought against the military regime. She was arrested and spent more than 2 years in custody in the early 70s, during which time she faced intense torture. Bolsonaro became increasingly popular, driven by his penchant for shocking and inflammatory public statements. The election of Donald Trump in the United States in 2016 boded well for him. When the 2018 elections appeared on the horizon, current President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was leading the polls, but was soon convicted of corruption and arrested by Operation Car Wash. The center-left had no other strong candidate to put forward. For the moderate right, the vacuum was even greater. Groups as diverse as evangelicals, fans of the car wash operation, and members of the financial market then decided to support the candidacy of the extremist Bolsonaro. The military did the same. Many hoped that the moderate right-wing forces would be able to control Bolsonaro and keep him in check while in power. But he was never disciplined. A retired army captain, Bolsonaro left the military with a terrible image among his superiors. However, in 3 decades in the lower house of Congress, he worked to benefit the military whenever possible, fighting for better salary and pension benefits. His attacks on the National Truth Commission and his visits to military environments helped him win the support of generals in the 2018 elections. Together, they decided that his running mate would be Reserve General Hamilton Mourão, another admirer of the torturer Ustra. A stabbing attack that almost killed Bolsonaro 1 month before the elections further boosted their candidacy.
Esses marginais vermelhos serão banidos de nossa pátria. E seu Lula da Silva, se você estava esperando o Haddad ser presidente para assinar o decreto de indulto, eu vou te dizer uma coisa: você vai apodrecer na cadeia, petralhada! Vai tudo vocês para a ponta da praia!
The voice you've just heard is Jair Bolsonaro's, saying during a rally that his political opponents should be sent to the end of the beach, a well-known reference to a Navy base in Rio de Janeiro, where political opponents were murdered during the dictatorship. The captain and the general won the elections, and along with them, so did militarism, plus everything that it invokes. The SBT TV channel, for example, had no embarrassment in resuming at the end of 2018 the slogan that titles the series, Love It or Leave It, the story of which you already know.
Brasil, ame-o ou deixe-o.
Facing backlash, SBT pulled its commercial. Militarism, in turn, only went forward, as did the distorted narratives about the dictatorship.
Bolsonaro government would not classify as essentially a military government, because he is the result of a combining different social, economic, political forces in Brazil. But yeah, I mean, his government will act as an umbrella of conservative forces. And the militaries, the people with nostalgia from dictatorship, will join this alliance.
Bolsonaro used his position to celebrate the military regime and honor its members. He also had more military personnel at his government than the generals who presided over the country during the dictatorship. More than 6,000 military men and women were spread across the federal public administration. Members of the armed forces also gained positions in state-owned companies. The then-president went so far as to place an active general with no experience in the field to command the Ministry of Health during the COVID pandemic, after civilian health ministers had refused to adhere to Bolsonaro's scientific denialism. In order not to stop the economy, which would harm his government, Bolsonaro promoted the use of ineffective medicines against the disease to encourage the boycott of social isolation. General Eduardo Pazuello and his advisors, also from the military, managed the situation terribly. And Brazil, despite having an extensive public health system, was very late in the international dispute over the purchase of vaccines. In the first 2 years of the health crisis, Brazil had one of the highest death tolls in the world, in absolute terms and per capita. The military also ended up involved in suspicions of corruption in the negotiation of immunizers.
I wouldn't say there was an opposition inside the military of military engagement in politics. I did a research in 2020, at the beginning of 2020, and Rafael Villa and I, we asked out to some militaries what did they think about the militaries being appointed as ministers during Bolsonaro. And They had like the same discourse, which signals this was an institutional discourse, that there was a difference between the individual engagement in the government, which they thought it was the case, and the institutional engaging in the government, which they didn't at 2020. These officers, the active duty officers, they were emphasizing, okay, there are military ministers, but it's not the army is a navy that is really engaging in politics, which is false, as we see, because the last government, there was a clear politicization of the military from high ranking and low ranking, and also the losing of hierarchies.
That individual military engagement in the government and its problematic policies did not only happen in the health field. The adherence of high-ranking military personnel to Bolsonarism, contrary to the constitution and legislation, was manifested in the annual commemorations of the 1964 coup, and also in the neglect of indigenous lands, which saw huge increases in trespassing from miners and loggers, and also in the army's uncontrolled licensing of weapon permits for civilians, and also in the silence in the face of the president's attempts to use the armed forces to corner the Supreme Court, as the press has found out since 2020, and also in the challenge of the integrity of the electoral system without any proof, and also in support of Bolsonaro's re-election. He ran in 2022 alongside another reserve general, Walter Braga Neto, who was a cabinet minister in his government. and also in defense through an official statement from the three armed forces of the legitimacy of the protest camps that Bolsonaro supporters set up in front of barracks across the country to call for military intervention to prevent the inauguration of Lula, winner of the 2022 elections. In other words, to call for a coup d'etat. It was from a camp of this type in Brasilia that thousands of Bolsonaro supporters marched to invade the Three Powers Square on January 8, 2023. From there, those dissatisfied with the electoral result invaded the offices of the presidency, the Supreme Court, and the Congress, in a similar way to the invasion of the American Capitol in January 2021. The presidency's institutional security office, managed by military personnel, had dispensed with reinforcing security at the government's headquarters. On the day of the riots, army generals even prevented police from arresting the vandals who returned to the camp in front of the barracks. The military then began to be investigated in connection with January 8. Also under investigation in other inquiries related to Bolsonaro, Lieutenant Colonel and the former president's close aide Mauro Cid has been a central figure, and he's already reported that coup plans were being discussed within the government. The Supreme Court, now taking a tougher stance than in the past, decided that it will be the one to handle investigations into the military's role in the coup attempt instead of the historically lenient military courts. A Senate inquiry also did not hesitate to point a finger at several members of the armed forces as being responsible for attempting a coup. Even so, Supreme Court justices and congressmen continue to adopt the idea that the putschism was carried out by certain individuals and not by the armed forces institutionally. According to the federal police, investigations have shown that at least the then Navy commander Almir Garnier guaranteed Bolsonaro military support for a coup d'etat. He had already refused to respect Lula's authority. Like the former president, Garnier remained silent during a federal police hearing. Bolsonaro publicly denies having attempted a coup. Regarding the commanders of the Army and Air Force, skeptical observers argue that if they did not join the coup plot, it was not exactly because they are faithful to democratic values. U.S. influence may have contributed to their distancing from putschism. As the Brazilian report showed in 2022 and 2023, U.S. lawmakers threatened to cut off military aid if democracy was tampered with, and the Joe Biden White House made a concerted pro-democracy effort to pressure pro-Bolsonaro generals not to launch a putschist movement. Washington made it clear that it would trust the results of the 2022 elections despite Jair Bolsonaro's efforts to discredit them. An investigation by the Brazilian report also found that U.S. diplomacy played a key role in helping Brazil's electoral authorities overcome a global semiconductor shortage to seek the chips necessary to make new voting machines operational, denying Bolsonaro an additional argument to deny the election.
The international factor, yes, this surely it played a role. I would say more general grounds in terms of what are the ideas right now and about what is a legitimate government, and also the role of international organizations in general, right? Because Brazil, if it turned to an authoritarian regime, it will be expelled from, for example, the OEA, no? Organization of American States, that have a democratic law. So if the government turns an authoritarian government, it is expelled. And if the military coup was successful, that surely would entail like a negative impact in the economy. And many militaries, of course, these people study, right? Economy, international politics, geopolitics. So many militaries were aware of this different context.
The professional press, civil society organizations, important business actors, Supreme Court justices, and several other institutions openly opposed the coup. The silence of a supposed national conciliation in the post-dictatorship period had to give way to vocal defenses of democracy. The trials of the architects of a 21st century coup, however, are still pending, as is the one on the dictatorship's amnesty law. Meanwhile, civilian governments fail in preserving and promoting the memory of what happened during the dictatorship period. The military, in turn, has already made it clear that it continues to propagate its own. This podcast series is written by me, Isabela Cruz, and produced by André Chiavassa. The script was edited by Ewan Marshall. We'd also like to thank Professors Anaís Passos and Emilio Meyer for their participation. As always, we ask you to give us a 5-star rating wherever you get your podcasts. It takes only a second, and it will help us reach a broader audience. Or better yet, sign up for the Brazilian Report, the journalistic engine behind this project. Thank you very much for accompanying us on this transnational visit to the past, which in Brazil remains so present.